You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, December 21st, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live depths from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Bass Professor of Government at Harvard University, Michael Sandel, on the tyranny of merit. What's become of the common good? And meanwhile, an imminent vote on COVID rescue package happening today. $900 billion, but spoiler alert, not enough. The Moderna vaccine starts to ship and new priority guidelines established, but why is our government not deploying more resources to push the timeline up for all of us to be vaccinated? UK reports that a mutated version of the coronavirus spreads at a 70% faster rate. But our Surgeon General says not necessarily more fatal. The House Select Subcommittee on COVID subpoenas Health and Human Services Alex Azar and CDC's Robert Redfield for documents detailing the political suppression of COVID data and guidance. Meanwhile, in the White House, Trump and Tommy Tuberville huddle in a last-ditch effort to stay in the White House. So proud of myself. USDA food aid still has yet to reach millions of low-income children. And Smartmatic's cease and desist letter has Fox News celebrities in a hard about face on their election conspiracies. Warren and Jayapal introduce a ban of lawmaker stock trades, potentially cutting deeply into Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue's major sources of income. And lastly, rest in peace, Leo Panitch, an editor of the Socialist Register for 25 years and a Canadian research chair in political economy and political science at York University. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us. I hope your weekend was okay. Emma, I know that you were very busy betting on football games. I don't know if you want me to be that explicit, but
I wasn't betting on football games because I had too much emotional investment in my fantasy team this weekend. I was in the semifinals in the league where there was a significant payout, and we lost. We lost despite outscoring our projection by 20, 30 points. The other team just had a monster day. So.
There it is. Emma came in. That was the first thing I heard about. She came in the office.
I care about the important things in life.
Lost the big rotisserie football pool. Well, I'm sorry, but better not next year, I guess, right? I mean,
exactly.
There should be an asterisk against this year anyways, right? I mean,
yeah, it was incredible. I mean, we had the first overall pick and took Saquon Barkley, and he tore his ACL week two, and we still were in the top four. So I take this as a win for the year for sure.
Yes. Well, I will give you that win because I didn't understand anything you just said. But that said, I hope your weekend was good. We are in the final week of our live shows for 2020. And all I can say is good riddance. Good riddance to 2020. We will get deep into the rescue package that we are expecting will pass today. It is nothing particularly bad in the bill, just an It's just insufficient. Right. It's insufficient for the moment. It is insufficient. It is astonishing the ability of the U.S. government. How much of an ability the U.S. government has to move the timeline from when they are saying everyone will be vaccinated, which is maybe late fall 2021. The ability to move that timeline up 3 or 4 months is certainly within the capacity of the wealthiest nation on earth. I got a story right here. In Germany, they are awaiting their vaccine. They are building mass vaccination centers and built them less than a week. Meanwhile, we are relying on perhaps the drive-through of some pharmacies to deliver this vaccine. We have the ability, the president does now, and the president and the incoming president does, to use the Defense Production Act to ramp up the production of these vaccinations. But apparently, at this point, our lawmakers don't feel it's necessary to set up any type of major infrastructure. And just contemplate how many billions, hundreds of billions of dollars would be saved, if that's what you're concerned about in terms of the economy, by pushing up that timeline. Never mind the lives and the just sort of the general well-being. And I only say that, I only put it in that order, I should be clear, because that seems to be the
purported concern of the Trump administration, even though they're basically playing with house money at
exactly.
this point. I mean, this is what the government is for. If the government is for anything, it is to step up and provide some sort of structure in this national, international pandemic. But they are instead focused on cutting costs.
It is insane. We will talk more about that later in the program. And in a moment, we will have Professor Michael Sandel with us. In the meantime, this is the season of giving. Many folks looking to for charities. We get a lot of questions as to, you know, what charities we recommend around here. I can tell you that for over 10 years, GiveWell.org has helped donors find the charities and projects that save and improve lives most per dollar. And this is how they do it. They spend over 20,000 hours a year researching charitable organizations. They handpick a few of the highest impact evidence-based charities. All that research publicly available, totally for free on their website. Since 2010, GiveWell has helped over 50,000 donors direct over $500 million to the most effective charities. GiveWell never takes any fees. All of your tax-deductible donations are given to the charity you choose. I can tell you that I've mentioned this before, over Hanukkah, the kids, they get to pick a couple of charities in lieu of one or two nights of presents, depending on their age. I'm not going to get into the specifics. and they're fairly good-natured about it. At least the older one is. The younger one is actually pretty good about it, too. But one of the sites that I gave them to look at was GiveWell. And to choose out, I mean, for me personally, I found Give Directly, I think it's called, where you literally just, they target people in this country, other countries, low-income folks, maybe folks who have been hit by COVID, direct money, essentially, is all it is. And, you know, there's a lot of research out there. And this is just for my purposes. A lot of research out there that shows the incredible effectiveness of just giving people money because they know how to spend it the best. There are other charities on there that you can check out. They have all been thoroughly researched for their impact, dollar for dollar. That's what's so great about GiveWell.org. Give Directly, I don't know if it's associated with it. I don't know. I think the give may be just a coincidence. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. You only have a few days left to make a tax-deductible donation before the new year. Go right now. And when you make your first donation to GiveWell, your gift will be matched up to $250. Just go to givewell.org/majority, pick podcast, and Majority Report at checkout. This matching offer is good only for as long as funds last. Get your first donation matched up to $250. givewell.org/majority and select podcast and Majority Report at checkout. Okay, now it's my pleasure to welcome to the program Michael Sandelli. Teaches political philosophy at Harvard University, where he is the Ann T. and Robert M. Bass Professor of Government. His latest book is The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good. Professor, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, Sam. Emma?
So, well, let's just start, I guess, with, you know, what the term meritocracy purports to mean. It started out as something slightly different than I think it's been deployed over the past 30 years. Tell us about that.
Yes. In many ways, we think of meritocracy as a good thing, as an ideal even of a just society. It's the idea that if everyone has an equal chance, an equal start in life, then the winners will deserve their winnings. That's the attractive way, Sam, of stating the ideal. But there are two problems these days with meritocracy that I've described in my book, The Tyranny of Merit. One of them is that we don't live up to the meritocratic principles we profess. Chances are not truly equal. We all know this. But there's a deeper problem, and this is the more provocative claim in the book. Even if we did, even if somehow we could make chances truly equal opportunity, still meritocracy would have a dark side. And that dark side has to do with the tendency of the winners to believe that their success is their own doing, the measure of their merit, and by implication, that those who lose out, those who fall short, have no one to blame but themselves. And we're seeing this dark side in our politics today. I think it's part of what's fueled the populist backlash against elites.
All right. Well, I want to just go back before we get into those two problems, because I want people to understand that, because the term meritocracy was coined as a to describe a problem, essentially.
Yes. Yes. And we easily forget that.
Remind us of that, because I think that's important. It's fascinating to me just that we have taken that term, and over the course of, I guess, really 30 years, from the 1950s when it was coined to when it was started to be deployed by politicians, turned that term on its head.
Into an
exactly. Right. Exactly. Go ahead, Emma. Did you have something?
No, that was just my contribution there. I wanted to hear from you.
Okay. Well, yes, that's exactly right. The term was coined by a sociologist, a British sociologist named Michael Young, who wrote a book called The Rise of the Meritocracy in 1958. And he was describing not an ideal society, but a dystopia. Now, this was at a time when the British class system, aristocratic hierarchy, was breaking down, and more members of the working class, children of the working class, were able to get an education and compete. But he saw the dark side, and he coined meritocracy to describe a society that he imagined would result sometime in the future if everyone came to believe that where they landed in life was truly the result of their own doing, rather than the result of the accident of birth, as in aristocratic societies. And he was not defending aristocracy by any means. He was a Labour Party activist, thinker. But he thought that this would generate a sense of entitlement among those who would feel they had earned their success, and that it would be demoralizing, humiliating even, for those who struggled, because they would say to themselves, I had a chance. Maybe I just lacked the talent and effort to succeed. So that was Michael Young's dystopian scenario when he coined the term meritocracy. And then, Sam, just as you say, by the 1980s and 90s, meritocracy became an ideal that was invoked by politicians across the political spectrum. And it became really the defining political project. I call it the rhetoric of rising. How often have we heard it? If only we can remove barriers to success, then everyone will be able to rise as far as their efforts and talents will take them, and we'll have a just society. And this is the picture that has a dark side, an implicit insult that meritocratic elites have missed.
I'm thinking Thatcher had rhetoric of this rhetoric of rising. Bill Clinton, Americans want, if they play by the rules, to move up, the implication is that there's nothing wrong with the system. And therefore, if it doesn't happen, that they're arguing about making sure the system is functioning in that way. And then if it doesn't, it is the fault of the individual that they haven't risen in some fashion. How did that happen though? How did we go from that? I mean, it reminds me of the phrase "pull yourself up by your bootstraps" was also introduced as a satire, because it's impossible to pull yourself up by the bootstraps. At one point in the development and the colloquialization of that term, it becomes like an edict. And how does that happen? What philosophies were deployed that made society accept the complete opposite of what the meaning of that term was?
It's very interesting how this happened. And it begins to enter into mainstream public discourse in a big way in the 1980s and 1990s. And what's interesting is that it begins with very stringent notions of individual responsibility introduced by Reagan and Thatcher. And of course, they were defending free market, robust free market, laissez-faire individualism against the idea of the welfare state. So they deployed this idea of individual responsibility for one's fate and merit, rising based on your own effort. And what's striking is that when they passed from the political scene and were succeeded by center-left politicians and parties, Bill Clinton in the US, Tony Blair in Britain, they moderated but consolidated the market faith of the Reagan and Thatcher years. They softened its harsh edges, but they didn't fundamentally challenge it. To the contrary, the meritocratic rhetoric they embraced and elaborated and put right at the center of politics. And this is what I describe. And I track this in the book because it's now possible actually to chart the frequency of the use of various political phrases, like rising as far as your efforts and talents will take you, for example, or what you earn will depend on what you learn. Bill Clinton, for example, reiterated this. Tony Blair spoke explicitly about merit and meritocracy. And then into the Obama years, "You can make it if you try." Turns out Obama used that phrase more than 140 times in his speeches. You can make it if you try. So it was actually, it began this embrace of meritocracy as a response to inequality, began with Reagan and Thatcher, but was embraced and became a part of mainstream center-left liberal public discourse.
Well, there's also just this kind of arrogant approach there where you think that you can empirically measure meritocracy or a system that allows for meritocracy when there's really no way to do that. It can be a rigged system, but people can still believe that it's correct. It reminds me about that UC Berkeley monopoly study where they favored it. They told people that it would be rigged in certain players' favor. And then they started to believe, though, that they earned and that they were winning Monopoly psychologically, even though they knew that they had been given more money or whatever. How can you differentiate between some utopia of a meritocracy and a system that's set up so perfectly and one that people only purport to be equal?
Well, yeah, it's very interesting, Emma, what you're suggesting. And there have been studies across countries about whether people believe it is possible to rise from humble origins based on effort and hard work. And overwhelmingly, when asked this question, Americans say yes. Hard work will get you to the top. And in European countries, for the most part, there's much more skepticism about this idea that hard work will be the engine of upward mobility. And what's paradoxical is, though we Americans console ourselves with the widening inequalities by saying, well, but it's possible to rise. We're a mobile society, unlike old Europe, where people are stuck in the class of their birth. It's actually the opposite now. Rates of upward mobility one generation to the next are less in the United States than they are in many European countries, even though we believe more fervently that it's possible to rise. So this version of responding to inequality, not directly, not through structural reform of the economy, but by telling people, go to college, then you can rise. That's been a powerful American idea. And I think it's actually weakened the American progressive project in recent decades, because it's distracted us. It's been almost a kind of alternative to contending with the deepening inequality that market-driven globalization has given us.
So, okay. And so that is part of your first critique, I should say, which is that the idea of our meritocracy is an illusion, because the meritocracy as it is set up in this country is, in fact, not really a meritocracy on its own terms. And that is because the moment I am born, if I am from a certain zip code, I have advantages that are hidden and will push me through that meritocracy the whole way through. I also have a subset of that before we move on to the second one, that has been in my head for 25 years. I think actually I talked about it in a basement in Harvard Square in a comedy club. I was not a very good comedian, but this idea of a meritocracy, it is set up by the people who decide what the metrics are within that meritocracy necessarily will choose values that they happen to excel at, right? I mean, if I'm, I think at the time I would say, like, you know, if we were setting up a meritocracy when I was a kid growing up in Worcester, it would be how many Busch beers can you drink in a parking lot? And that's how we would determine who would rise in our meritocracy. But that's just because that's what we did.
And you were good at that.
And I was pretty good at it, not as good as some of the others, but I was a middling, but that is one of the problems with a meritocracy that you cannot escape in some way. And is that really a sort of like your second critique, is that the idea of any meritocracy, never mind that ours is deficient, any meritocracy necessarily is going to devalue people in some type of arbitrary fashion?
Yes. Let me say just one more word about the first critique, that we don't live up to the meritocracy we proclaim. If you look at SAT scores, so one measure, unlike the beer drinking measure, one measure that the meritocracy uses to determine who gets into selective colleges and universities is the SAT. But, and the SAT was set up precisely to compensate for the fact that some kids went to fancy schools where they could learn Greek and Latin, and other kids went to public schools where they didn't teach that stuff. But in practice, the SAT strongly tracks family income. The higher your family income, the greater the chance of getting a good score on the SAT. And if you look at the student bodies of Ivy League universities today, there are more students from the top 1% in these places than there are from the bottom half of the country combined. So this bears out the first point that you were emphasizing, Sam. But as for the second, the question is it really true that even if we had a perfect meritocracy, is it really true that people deserve the winnings that come from landing on top? To show why this, I think, is doubtful, take a concrete example. LeBron James is a great basketball player, and he makes tens of millions. Now, part of it is effort. He trains very hard, but I could practice 24 hours a day for my whole life and never be a great basketball player. Part of it are natural talents and gifts. But is it LeBron's doing, or is it his good luck that he is such a gifted athlete? And more than this, is it his doing that he happens to live in a society and at a time when we love basketball and reward it lavishly if you're really good at basketball? If he had lived, or is that too his good luck? If he had lived back in the days of the Renaissance, they didn't care much about basketball. They cared more about fresco painters. So these are elements of contingency and luck and fortune and also indebtedness that we easily forget. By we, I mean those of us here who, though perhaps less gifted than LeBron, succeed in one way or another. We forget the luck, and meritocracy invites us almost to forget the good luck that helps us on our way.
That's, I think, what Emma was saying with the Monopoly experiment. Let me just ask, and I just want to maybe I will migrate my beer drinking meritocracy analogy to the basketball, because there seems to be also another element, right? And we have different, there can be different meritocracies that exist in any given society. You can have a mercantilist versus a militarist, let's say, a type of meritocracies. Using basketball, it's not just that LeBron is lucky because basketball happens to be popular now, as opposed to, like, you know, Bob Cousy in the 50s, or that he got lucky because he's also, you know, a great athlete and he's tall, but it's also, it's as if LeBron was in charge of setting up a game and saying, well, I'm 6'10" or something. We're going to put the basket, we're going to put the hoop at 10 feet instead of 5 feet. Right. And like that everything emanates from the ability to construct the rules of the game in such a way.
And that's just the game of basketball is what would be claimed.
And then, right? Then the idea is basketball is a natural phenomena. It just happens to exist. But it's not. And it's constructed by people who, in the context of our society, who know, maybe they're not even conscious of it, they say being able to dunk is the highest of values. Just so happens they're all above 6'5" or something and have, a great vertical leap. I mean, that too is a question of like power. And this seems to me to be part of like the neoliberal, and I'm talking Mont Pelerin, sort of, I guess, ideas that have infected our societies in many respects.
Yes. And if we think about how the rules of the game have been set up, if we look broadly at our economy and our society and our politics, the fundamental rules of the game Well, for purposes of this discussion, Sam, Emma, are two. The rules of the game of the market, and also increasingly of higher education. Take higher education first. We have in recent decades made higher education the arbiter of opportunity in a meritocratic society. Colleges and universities dispense the credentials and define the merit that our society, a meritocratic society, rewards. As a result, the ability to do well on standardized tests and to get good grades and to do well in school have become not only privileged in deciding who will make a lot of money, but have been valorized as the basis of social recognition and esteem. One of the problems, though, is that most people don't have a four-year college education. We easily forget this. Nearly two-thirds of Americans do not. So it's folly, I think, to create an economy that sets as a necessary condition of dignified work and a decent life a four-year college degree that most people don't have. So that's part of the problem. And the broader problem, talking about the rules, how the rules are designed, you mentioned the neoliberal way of defining the rules. Over the last four decades, we've embraced market mechanisms with an intensity in defining who gets ahead and who gets rewarded. And we've slid into the assumption that the money people make is the measure of their contribution to the common good. But this is a mistake. This is something we need to critically reflect on. And it connects with your point, Sam, about not only how the talents and gifts are allocated and in the role of fortune and luck and accident, but also what qualities are prized by the rules that are in place in allocating not only material goods, but honor, recognition, and esteem.
So let's talk about the reform, because you contrast the idea of equality of opportunity, which is what we have been sold through the 90s, 80s, 90s, aughts, if you will. And you contrast that with the equality of result or outcome. And you say that there's also sort of there's another perspective, which you called the democratic equality of condition. Explain that those concepts to us. And then I don't want to get ahead of myself, but explain those concepts to us.
Right. Democracy does not require that everyone have the same income and wealth. But it does require that we have a sense that we share a common life. And this requires a range of things. It requires broad democratic access to learning, to education, and especially to civic education. It requires that everyone, whatever role they perform in the society, whatever work they do, be able to win honor and recognition and appreciation for the contributions they make. So part of what I'm suggesting to bring us closer, to rely less on equality of opportunity and meritocracy, and to bring us closer to a broad democratic equality of condition, by which I really mean a kind of equality of respect, where everyone can hold his or her head up high and look others directly in the eye and voice their opinions, regardless of differences of class or ethnicity or race. I think we need to shift our focus from arming people for meritocratic competition. That's the rhetoric of rising. That's you can make it if you try. That's responding to inequality by saying, well, maybe if you get a college degree, you too can escape it. We need to shift from that kind of arming people for meritocratic competition to focusing more in our politics on the dignity of work by asking what are the conditions that would accord dignity to work of all kinds, not only to the kinds of work that depend on four-year college degrees when most people don't have them, and that depend especially on having prestigious credentials. We have a steep hierarchy of esteem between higher education and especially competitive colleges and universities, on the one hand, and the forms of learning that most people depend on to prepare themselves for the world of work. I'm thinking of state colleges, two-year community colleges, vocational and technical training schools. We woefully underinvest in these forms of learning. Not only that, we don't accord them the honor and recognition and respect they deserve. And this has an effect on the lack of honor and recognition that we accord the people who prepare themselves for work of that kind, work that doesn't require a college degree. So those would be some of the starting points. We could talk about others, and in the book I have some other suggestions.
How do we achieve what you're talking about in the context of a capitalist society? Right. I mean, and I would also imagine, like, you know, really what we're also talking about is people who don't necessarily even attend a community college or a vocational school. I mean, you know, guys I knew growing up who are, you know, plumbers or electricians, some of them are doing very, very well. Sure. And, you know, it's like it's in terms of dollars and, you know, and maybe in certain circles, they're not as respected. But I mean, we're talking about people who are laborers, who are working in like service industry. But I mean, how within the context of a society where your value is so tied into your ability to function as a consumer, essentially, right. Or to segregate yourself from the rest of society because and their ills because of your money. Right. How do we do that in a capitalist society? Because we can't just say everybody needs to, you know, respect and not look down upon, you know, I don't know, the person who's, you know, ringing you up at the grocery market or something.
Right. It can't be merely hortatory. I think you're right about that. So part of it, I think, is shifting. And this is a matter of not only of economics, but of also values and of culture, shifting the public culture to think of ourselves not only or even primarily as consumers, but also as producers. Because a producer ethic invites us to think about the conditions for contributing and the conditions under which we value and recognize the contributions people make to the economy and to the common good, not only their purchasing power as consumers. And I argue in the book that the producer ethic, more than the consumer ethic, which has predominated in recent decades, the producer ethic is more conducive to a civic ethic, a democratic ethic. Now, how might we begin this shift? You were mentioning forms of work, Sam, that don't even involve trades like plumbers and electricians, but service workers, retail workers. It's been interesting during this pandemic. There is a kind of opening because we've all learned something, become unmistakably aware of something. Those of us with the luxury of working from home, recognize, can't help but recognize, how deeply we depend on workers we often overlook. Not only the doctors and nurses caring for COVID patients in the hospitals, but I'm thinking also of delivery workers, warehouse workers, grocery store clerks, home health care providers, truck drivers, childcare workers. These are not the best paid or most honored workers in our society. But now we are all calling them essential workers. This could be, now this may fade as the pandemic recedes, but it could be the opening for a broader public debate about how to bring their pay and recognition into better alignment with the importance of the work they do, work whose importance we recognize now in the midst of this pandemic.
Does the, I got to say, I'm a little bit skeptical only because we just had a COVID relief bill that had no recognition of that at all. In fact, they were able to strip hazard pay out of the bill for these essential workers. And so, but when you say producer, aren't you really saying labor?
And, yeah. Yes.
And there, it seems to me that we as a society don't necessarily have the ability to say to UPS, pay your drivers more or this and that. But as a society, what we do have the ability is to decommodify a lot of the things that everybody needs.
Yeah.
Therefore, once you have those basic needs met by society, the idea, I mean, that's society right there saying we recognize your labor, your existence, in some fashion or another contributes to the existence of our society. And therefore, this is a baseline. And anything right above that, you know, is secondary. But here's the way that we say everybody has dignity. We give you these decommodified things, healthcare, maybe housing, education, just as a start, right?
Right. Well, I'm in favor of all of that, Sam. And I like the idea of framing it as decommodifying essential human and civic goods, healthcare, education, housing, and the like. And we could extend that to include a truly public transportation system, including public parks and recreation, including the civic infrastructure for a common life, which gets back to this idea of a broad democratic equality of condition. So I think that's an important starting point. But I think we also, while it's true we can't tell private companies, well, we can actually tell private companies that they can't pay their workers less than a minimum wage or a living wage. So I wouldn't give up on that. We can strengthen unions so that workers can have a voice, not only with their private employers, but also in politics more generally. And we can take measures, various regulatory reforms, that undo a lot of the damaging reforms in the other direction we've seen in recent decades with the deregulation of finance, for example, preventing stock buybacks, and various other measures that would go some way toward redressing the imbalance and the injustice that's introduced even before the social safety net and redistributive politics gets going. Wage subsidies is another topic that we could discuss. So I like your idea very much of decommodifying these essential human and civic goods and services. But I think we also need to debate how to reconfigure the economy in a way not only that redistributes income and access to the good things in life across the society, but also that affirms the dignity of the work that everyone does, regardless of the credentials required to achieve it.
Lastly, I just want to talk about this notion, and I'm not, you know, I agree with that prescription. I can't help but think that, you know, the most cohesive way society can say to everyone that you have value is to actually give them things directly of value. And we can still have the, you know, those those secondary, which I perceive them as secondary reforms in the sense that, like, look, if it's much easier for me to have, we want to strengthen unions so that we can have bargaining power in the, you know, between labor and management. Giving me healthcare so that I can leave this job and not have to worry about that. That's going to give me some power. In that relationship. If I have child,
of course,
it's going to give me power, et cetera, et cetera. But I want to just turn back just to a moment to that turn where the liberal establishment adopted this sort of more market friendly perspective. And this individualism, I was struck by that in your book. It reminds me of this, I think it's Adam Curtis, is that who it is? He had this documentary, Hypernormalization, which I don't know if you're familiar with. He's a British documentary who talks about that turn in the 70s where the left lost part of its communitarian perspective and saw its power in individualism.
Yeah.
To me, that atomization seems to be sort of fundamental, because once you become more atomized, then it's like every person for themselves. And if I can figure out a system that's going to put me up and, you know, then you're creating a hierarchy in many respects. And then everybody wants to be at the top of that hierarchy in some fashion or another.
Well, I agree that the market turn, the market friendly turn of liberal and progressive politics and the deregulation that went with it. We've talked some about the policies, but more pervasive and corrosive was the uncritical embrace, I think, by liberal and progressive politics and political parties of a kind of market-based individualism of the kind that you're describing. And when it's connected to the meritocratic attitudes towards success that we've been discussing, then it becomes deeply corrosive and it inclines credentialed meritocratic elites to look down on those less credentialed than themselves. And this creates, I think, the anger and resentment, the sense of grievance that has roiled our politics, that paved the way to Donald Trump, and we see it happening in many European democracies. One last element here, and we've talked a lot about the values and the cultural shift that, so I argue, we need to consider. Part of it has to do with the way the successful view their own success, our own success. Because the more I think of my success as my own doing, the measure of my merit, the harder it is to imagine myself in other people's shoes. The harder it is for me to say, there, but for the accident of birth or the grace of God or the luck of the draw, go I. And so to the individualism, together with the meritocratic hubris, as I call it in the book, makes it very difficult to achieve the sense of solidarity, of shared citizenship, that a politics of the common good requires. So one of the obstacles to the more generous social welfare state and public provision that you've described and that I agree with wholeheartedly, it's important to see, I think, that one of the obstacles to achieving it, apart from the economic interests that may be arrayed against it, are the attitudes towards success, the meritocratic hubris that is corrosive, ultimately, of the common good. So this is really to describe a political and economic project that is, at the same time, Sam, Emma, a moral and even spiritual project to reconsider our attitudes towards success.
Michael Sandel, the book is The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good. Thanks so much for your time today. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, quick break, and we will be back in a moment. We are back, ladies and gentlemen. We didn't see much of that, of what Sandel was talking about in the context of the debate over this relief package, as it were. And it is it's very limited. We'll go through more. Tomorrow we're going to break down the details of it after the final vote. But and we'll talk also about the politics of it, both in terms of what it means to pass this now and the question of why wasn't there an attempt to pass this earlier? But here is Mitch McConnell celebrating this stimulus that is going to presumably pass today. He is also excited because it gives David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler something to talk about for those Republican voters that may have felt like maybe we need to have a democratically controlled Senate to get some type of stimulus. Here is Mitch McConnell.
For the American people, we can finally report what our nation has needed to hear for a very long time. More help is on the way. Moments ago, in consultation with our committees, the four leaders of the Senate and the House finalized an agreement. There'll be another major rescue package for the American people. If our citizens continue battling this coronavirus this holiday season, they will not be fighting alone. We've agreed to a package of nearly $900 billion. It is packed with targeted policies that help struggling Americans who've already waited entirely too long.
Now, of course, Mitch McConnell could have passed a even bigger bill, well, 7 months ago, 5 months ago, 4 months ago, 2 months ago, at any time. He could have had a bigger bill had he wanted one. There was a $1.8 trillion offer supposedly on the table coming from the White House. We don't know the specifics in that. It's gone back and forth. It's all the reporting. But it would have been maybe a different story had Nancy Pelosi said, okay, we'll take that, and then forced Mitch McConnell to either vote it down, not bring it to a vote, or vote for it at the time. That did not happen. That's where we are now. We will litigate that. I have been litigating that for, well, quite a long time. But here is Nancy Pelosi talking about this bill. Again, no city or state funding whatsoever. Not a dollar. Not a dollar.
We also have in the legislation direct payments, which were not in the Republican bill, to America's working families. I would like them been bigger, but they are significant, and they will be going out soon.
That is the what Pelosi is trumpeting when people ask, why didn't you just, this is very close to what Mitch McConnell wanted with his skinny bill that they passed in the Senate a couple of times, or at least brought up and was filibustered. Why didn't you just take that? And it comes down to the $600 per person in a family if your family is under $75,000. That's helpful. I mean, there are some families that can't raise $400, but at this point, we're 9 months out. We're still maybe 6, 7, 8, 9 months out until, you know, most people get vaccinated. That is woefully insufficient and still giving McConnell and Kelly Loeffler and Perdue something to run on. I mean,
and by the way, Steve Mnuchin is saying that these checks could go out within a week or something like that, that they could potentially be deposited into people's bank accounts quite quickly. I'm not sure if he's just posturing there, but say theoretically these checks hit people's bank accounts before the Georgia runoffs, Mitch McConnell wins again. I mean, the point is that Pelosi has no explanation for why she turned down the $1.8 trillion deal that was ostensibly on the table and put it in McConnell's court. She's not answering questions. CNN is asking her about it, and she's walking out of the room because it was done for political purposes. And so now we have a weaker bill because of it.
And look, I can understand doing things for political purposes, if that's what it is, and we should make the assessment. But I don't even know that that was a politically smart move to make. And if so, I don't understand why you do it now, as opposed to wait till after the Georgia election. Because if the politics made sense then, I don't understand how they don't make sense now. But I don't. I mean, And I'm open to an explanation.
And it wasn't even an effective political move then, because newsflash, the Democrats thought they were going to take a lot more seats back in the Senate, and they didn't, even if they win these two runoffs, and they lost seats in the House.
And the real problem is that Joe Biden may have gotten into office because of it. I suppose that could be the argument, that not, you know, preventing Donald Trump from doing another bill would have helped, helped Joe Biden get into office. But Joe Biden's going to have a heck of a time, and the Democrats are going to have a heck of a time in 2022 if cities and states are engaging in massive layoffs and massive cuts to programs. That is how you a lack of government spending on those levels is how you're going to wind up with an anemic.
It's about more than winning. It's about investing so they can win in 2022.
Exactly. All right. Well, that's it for us today. We will go through that bill more tomorrow. If you missed any part of this program, remember it plays at 5 p.m. and at 10 p.m. on the Choice channel on the Peacock app, or you can just go in and search Cedar, S-E-D-E-R, and find any of our archive shows or our most recent one. We will see you tomorrow, unless you are staying with us, in which case we will see you right now.
We're seeing you right now. Hello.
You're being seen, ladies and gentlemen.
I see you, as they say in Avatar.
What's Avatar? Is that movie?
The biggest movie of all time.
No, I mean, I
think
I saw it on an airplane or something.
It is forgettable, though, for the biggest movie of all time.
That's what I was about to say, right? Like, usually movies that are that successful, they have resonance in the public consciousness. Sam doesn't even know one of the three main taglines. Do you know the mineral they were trying to get in that movie?
I know, all honesty.
It's the stupidest name of all time.
I was on an airplane. What was it?
Unobtainium.
Was it hard to obtain?
I think.
I get that sense.
I hate it so much.
I don't remember that movie.
They're blue.
Things go in and out. The only thing I remember is Black Bear. That was a great movie.
Yes.
Great film. Matthew Film Guys. Did I talk about that already? I did, right?
Yeah.
Because I watched it after, not this past weekend. This past weekend I watched Iron Man 1 and 2. So, did that.
Yeah, you told me that already.
Yep. Saul made me watch those, and
Iron Man 1's pretty good.
Better than the Avenger movies. Folks, just a reminder, this show exists because of your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show, you get the fun half as well. jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget AM Quickie. Get your headlines every morning, amquickie.com, or you can just search AM Quickie on your podcast app. We got merch, shop.majorityreportradio.com. Check that out. Don't forget Nomiki's show. Find the Nomiki show on YouTube at youtube.com/ Naomi Keyes show, and she does that Tuesday through Friday. Also, Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada's Twitch stream?
Hey, so, start my video. Hey, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep.
Yes, so this week on the Antifada, we are still in soft launch mode. Not really sure what the difference is between soft and hard, besides the fact that someday I assume we will no longer have half an hour of technical difficulties at the beginning of every broadcast. We've been doing that every Wednesday at 7 p.m. with a bunch of really cool guests. Don't really know what we're going to do this Wednesday, but that's the exciting part. You just got to tune in and find
out. Who knows what technical problems we
have. Yeah, exactly. And we also have our podcast still. Check out our episode from last week with Terrence Ray from Trillbillies. We talk about J.D. Vance's horrible book and movie, Hillbilly Elegy, and kind of use it as a jumping off point to talk about the political economy of rural America and the ways it has been damaged by neoliberal policy and ideology. And then this week, what do we got? Oh, it's a Christmas episode. It's a Dudes Rock episode. I'm not on it, but they talk about anti-Semitism. Jake Flores is there. It's very festive. So check that out too. Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
Matt, what's happening on in the super producer Matt Leck media empire?
Yeah, so in that Left Reckoning on Thursday night, we had an episode, David and I, on YouTube. We were talking about Alabama Amazon Union. And we talked about we played about 20 minutes of the Biden meeting with the black leaders Zoom call that The Intercept posted, which is very interesting. Everybody should watch that full thing if you kind of want to look into how Biden operates, because they make some interesting asks. I mean, some of them are a little bit critical about like the Vilsack appointment, which we also get into, and Biden just barks at them. It is bizarre. But the full thing is up at The Intercept, but we play about 20 minutes of that. So check that out. Oh, we also talk about Dan Crenshaw being bad. He lied about, so he followed a sex worker on Twitter over the last week and then said that it might be some kind of hack. So we looked deep, we gave him some operational security tips there. So check that out. And on Saturday, I did another Madden and Mark stream where I listened to the first two chapters of the 18th premiere while playing Madden. And I'm too good at Madden. So I started playing Cyberpunk to make it a little bit more interesting.
Why does he have to say that he was hacked? Why can't he just say it's Twitter and I'm following a sex worker on Twitter? Who cares?
I mean, that's what an alpha would do.
Yeah, he's in a super conservative Texas district that's gerrymandered for like all evangelicals basically outside of Houston.
Well, I'm spreading the gospel.
Yeah.
I would say I accidentally like fat fingered it and followed by accident. I don't know.
Or just like, I don't know. I mean, didn't like Jesus also talk to sex workers?
I've spent time in that district and I don't think they would be receptive to that message.
Fair enough. This is breaking news. This is pretty nuts. Jake Sherman, he's with Politico, correct?
Yes.
Yep.
He reports that they cannot get the COVID relief government funding bill. I guess they did both. This $1.4 trillion bill that I think they punted for a week, if I'm not mistaken, right? Or is that... or are they actually settled on the government funding bill? We got to double check on that. Uploaded to the internet. The computers keep bugging out. Several sources told me have heard about a corrupt file in the education piece of the bill. All sections need to be combined into one file. So
Jesus Christ.
I don't know if that's a function of like, you know, there's been these massive hacks of the computer systems, or if somebody just accidentally like had a virus on their computer as they were doing the education. I mean, God,
it's Betsy DeVos's last stand.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
DeVos is buying another game.
It's not outside the realm of possibility that there are people in the Trump administration who are just like, we're going to F this up. I mean, they're doing it with personnel. You know, I imagine that the attitude of some of these people is just like, let's just, you know, cause headaches. I don't know, but
they lost the text of the bill.
It's not that they lost.
I'm like, you guys got to email these things to yourselves. That's what I do.
Shit, everything got deleted. They can't seem to upload it to the internet, so nobody knows what's in the bill. I don't know.
BitTorrent.
Inhibit, the internet dog ate my bill.
If that's going to inhibit the vote, but we shall see. All right, 646-257-3920 is the number. If you want to be part of the phone of the program, you can call in. Otherwise, you can IM us. I am the show at by using our app, and the app is completely free. MajorityApp.com. It's an iOS or Android app, and you can IM the program. We will see you in the fun half.
RM for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Dennerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dennerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck! Fuck your mind!
Have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych.
Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Almost says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black Africans. And the alpha males are back, back, back. Black.
See Donald Trump out there? Doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock on us.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Back. Africans are black. Black. Alpha males are back. Black, black.
Come on. What? Come on. What? Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy. 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 Pussy.